What I'm trying to do is figure out the next set of problems that haven't been solved yet and solve those.
Why competition?
Whether it's a small business competing with a much larger one or whether it's two big companies, the best ones, the market leaders, the ones that compete the best, they have these big leaps and they don't tell anyone where they're going or what they're doing. And there's an unpredictability to it, which creates excitement.
Do you enjoy it?
I can't think of a better thing to do than create businesses and grow them. And there's nothing more exciting for me than being in competition.
Competition. It's essential for driving progress and innovation. Progress is essential for growing a business, and innovation often comes from thinking outside the box, not just from customer feedback. Let's talk to Dan Clark, see what he thinks. Dan, it's great to have you here with us again. This competition word was your idea for this podcast episode. Why did you choose this?
I think it's one of the most interesting topics in business, and it's the fun bit, I think. I think it's the bit that makes it the most exciting because, you know, you're not just competing against yourself, you're competing against others, and it's a race. It's a kind of, you know, attempt to outperform and to do better than and to improve quicker than. And so I'd like to think I'm pretty competitive. I've just born that way of sports, everything. And so it's the bit that I find the most exciting of everything. You know, I think I said before that the money often takes care of itself, but the really exciting bit is being in competition with others, yourself, and seeing what you can do. And so, yeah, I was looking forward to this one.
I often think about the lack of competition as being like a kid in a candy store, where the idea of no competition at all is like, oh yeah, that sounds fantastic. But I don't think it would take long at all before we start to find easier ways of doing things that don't serve the customer so well. We just progress in a far slower way, or maybe even start to go backwards. I'm going to guess that if I said to you, do you think the competition is a good thing? Then you're almost certainly going to say yes. But tell me your thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, it moves everything quicker, right? I guess it creates a certain pressure that means that you have to get it right. And there's a consequence of not getting it right. Whereas if there's no competition, the consequence is probably not much. It's, I'll just keep on trying until I get it right. Or, you know, there's no real downside to the failure. So, I think it goes hand in hand with winning, and that's pretty important.
So when it comes to things like private schools, either in the UK or in the Middle East or in America, what do you think they're looking for when they're choosing between two different suppliers who are competitors to each other?
Well, this is an interesting one because it goes back to that saying. It's who is it? It's Henry Ford, isn't it, that said if I asked the people what they wanted, they'd say the faster horses rather than cars. And I think this is one of the interesting things about competition, or maybe it's not competition, maybe it's about customer pain points or whatever. Is thinking about the fact that actually, what we're trying to do here is produce something that maybe solves problems they don't know they've got yet. And so one of the interesting things about, you know, what are people looking for is they're looking for something that serves the purpose or solves the problems that they know can be solved. I guess what I'm trying to do, what a lot of us are trying to do is figure out the next set of problems that haven't been solved yet and solve those. And that's how we kind of make real progress and we become more competitive. So as far as what are you know, schools looking for, that's going to vary, but actually their requirements are pretty modest. If you go to a school about, you know, my industry being websites and marketing, and say, what problems do you want to solve? They say, oh, the CMS is clunky and I don't like the design and, you know, this isn't quite right or that's not very good or what have you. And fine, you know, they are the pain points of the moment, but actually they're kind of small and basic and pretty simple to fix. And actually the problems are not that, really. The problems are, you know, how do we actually improve enrollment by 75% on what it is today? Like ambitious goals and then a series of tasks that kind of lead up to that goal. So my general finding, I guess, experience, both in and out of the education sector is, you know, what people ask for is the simple, straightforward stuff. What you're trying to give them is the next generation of problems to be solved. And so what we like to do, I think, which works incredibly well, is say, look, you know, listen to the customer, obviously, hear what the pain points are, obviously, but then completely blow their minds with what you then show them over the next 30, 40 minutes. It's not solving those specific problems, although you can obviously fix those nuances or have better integrations or whatever. But it's kind of saying, but hold on, like if you could reinvent all of this again, start again from scratch and build something that was without limitation, what would that look like? And is that this? So yeah, I mean, do people know what they really want until they see it? I don't think they do.
I guess as well with a lot of this, there's a level of confidence that's projected onto your prospective customers. If they're asking for, well, let's say a taxi to go to their local Waitrose, and what you're saying to them is, look, I'm gonna give to you your own limousine with your own personal chauffeur who can take you anywhere in the world. Of course, you need to go to Waitrose next week. That bit's covered off. But let's look at the bigger picture and the more important things. And, you know, they're going to be fully 100% assured that you're able to deliver that service, the bit that they're thinking that they're needing right now. But let me just clarify on what you're saying then, because you're talking about problems that they're saying, but then problems that they're not talking about. Are you talking about yourself developing products for the future which address the problems that they're not talking about, or actually actively selling them a service right now and raising or highlighting the problems to them that they haven't even thought about?
I think it's a bit of both. It's about figuring out the problems they don't even know exist and solving them, and then presenting not just the problem but the solution altogether, because there's nobody wants to hear more problems that they didn't know existed but with no answers. So you can say, well, I bet you find that this is a real frustration, don't you? And I bet this is caused endless amount of time or energy or lost opportunity. What if you didn't do it like that, you did it like this? And that's the kind of aha moment that you can give people, be it in a product demo or whatever it might be, to give them something really different and to make them think differently. But yeah, there's an interesting one of, as you go through, I guess, a business life cycle, you begin with a concept. Most people, I don't know how many people fully proof that concept with customer. It's probably one of the bigger mistakes, is people can build stuff without any real validation. But I get why, you know, you've got to get to market. You've got an idea. You want to bring it to fruition. And you spend a severe amount of time in that process building out your vision. And then there's a moment in time where you need to flip from your vision to product feedback from the customer. And then the direction of the product becomes not what you were thinking it was going to be, but something else, because that's where the customer's taking it and shaping it and the direction it needs to move in. This is certainly my experience. But then you've got this other kind of thing that needs to come in over the top of it, where you've got to then continue to innovate in the way that I talked about earlier. Because if you just listen to the customer requirements, they're the basics of, this is really annoying, or there's four clicks here and I wish there was one. All good stuff, solvable, but you're not going to solve the next big admissions issue or the next big marketing issue from customer feedback 99.9% of the time. There's a couple of occasions where someone's come to me and gone, if you did this, this would be great. And I'll say, do you know what? You're right. This is amazing idea and we should definitely do it. But, you know, if you look at all of our support tickets right now, they're kind of basic fundamental operational things. There's nobody there going, this is the next big step that we need to take as a school. Someone's got to do that for them. So, you know, we've kind of got two strands now. We've got customer feedback, iteration, and then large leaps forward, which are kind of company vision pieces, where we're saying, okay, where do we think we can take this and how can we add value in a, you know, huge way? And so I find development meetings where we've got, you know, improving what's already there, the iterative, and then the new, and trying to leap forward, as well as then kind of efficiency and making sure that the things that we've already built are effective as well. But I don't think that it's massively effective to ask customers what they want if you're trying to majorly innovate. You've got to kind of get out in front of it and say, where is this going? What's going to happen next? And also look at the technologies that are surrounding it. I mean, you can't do any podcast episode in business without talking about AI at the moment. And it's frightening. It's like, it's moving at such a pace that things that were kind of validated and known today just are kind of disproven 3 weeks later, or, you know, the capabilities are that much greater. So everything's moving so fast. You need to keep kind of checking and validating on your course, I think.
And do you think that when you're talking about these sort of product developments for the future and, you know, scoping out what people are going to be needing in the future or what they might not need right now or might not say they need right now, do you think that not nearly enough businesses are doing that, but instead they're just looking at how they're going to pay, you know, the salary bills over the next 6 months and just kind of meeting the immediate needs of the business instead of, you know, taking the almost, was it, you know, I remember when I was young, the Japanese used to have their 50-year plan. I'm not suggesting it should be a 50-year plan. Who knows what the world's going to look like in 50 years, 5 years even, for that matter. But do you think that far too many companies are just looking at the here and now?
I think they are, but there's two parts to that, really. Was like, I've never done a 5-year plan in my life because 5 years is too long. You know, we do yearly plans because I can tell you kind of what do I want to achieve in a year, and I've got some pretty good ideas. None of them really financial, actually. They're all related to product feature and end goal problem solving. They're not linked to financial. I said this before that I think the financial kind of tends to take care of itself. Too often we are looking kind of short term, but we don't want to go too far out, is the point I'm trying to make, is that, you know, 5-year plans are kind of too conceptual, and with technology moving as fast as it's moving right now, there's absolutely no way you can go out that far ahead. But if you are a business that's simply kind of reacting to inbound requirement and your product roadmap or your service roadmap or whatever it looks like is simply made up of those items, then you are moving much, much slower than somebody that is kind of trying to solve the future problems or the problems that don't necessarily exist today but will do with all the things that are happening external to it.
Now, it feels a bit weird to not mention Apple if we're talking about things like competition, because Apple seems to have sort of created their own world where, to an extent, they don't have much competition, I mean, depending on which product we're looking at within their family. But I mean, clearly they've done something a lot different to a lot of other companies to really set themselves apart. And certainly if you're bought into the whole Apple ecosystem, like I am, actually, I can't remember the last time I even considered buying a phone that's not an iPhone. So in that sense, you know, they are eliminating their competition as far as my own personal purchasing is concerned. But equally, I'm a bit cautious about us talking too much about Apple, because with a podcast called Scale Up Success, it is mainly smaller businesses, or businesses that are smaller than Apple, at least, that are going to be tuning in and listening to this. But nevertheless, tell me what you think about Apple and the approach that they've taken regarding competition.
This is a really good one, because this applies to small business and big business, and it's something we do, and I think was really important. Other people might disagree, but I think this is really important. And the two words I wrote down while you were mentioning Apple and talking about competition were secrecy and big leaps, because they're the two things that Apple do incredibly well. So the first thing is that you won't go online and find the Apple product roadmap. That doesn't exist. And the reason that the Apple product map roadmap doesn't exist is because they don't want a bunch of other people kind of seeing where they're going and copying them, essentially, or starting to get a sense of their direction and being able to replicate that. I'm a big believer that roadmaps are only ever put out there by companies that are behind. And they're actually, I guess, an admission of the fact that they are behind the curve and they're in desperate need of catching up. And here's all the things that are coming soon that are going to create parity with our other competitors. Because those that are out in front, you know, the Nikes of this world, I know we're talking about the big companies here, but with their Flyknit technology as an example, and that no one saw that coming. It was a complete new material. Nobody talked about it before in Nike. Same as with the Apple Watch, same as with some of the other technology, like even going back to the iPhone, the AirPods, you know, no one saw it coming. It wasn't part of a roadmap that next year there'll be some nice Bluetooth headphones coming out. It was, here's a date, something amazing is going to happen, and here's the product release, and it's done to fanfare. And what that means is the competition is 2 years behind, because that wasn't worked on last week and then conceived in a week. It's 2 years of secrecy to bring product to market, then to make these massive leaps. And that's kind of what I was talking about previously in terms of what businesses need to do, is they need to make these massive jumps ahead, predicting that Bluetooth technology and the audio could be delivered in a wireless function, even if it's not been quite done yet, and then going and doing it rather than producing another pair of wired headphones with another feature. It's that kind of mentality. And so whether it's a a small business competing with a much larger one, or whether it's two big companies, the best ones, the market leaders, the ones that compete the best, they have these big leaps and they don't tell anyone where they're going or what they're doing. And there's an unpredictability to it, which creates excitement, but also gives them 2 years ahead, maybe, or 1 year ahead, depending on how fast technology is moving, of ability to sell and gain market share. And that's what's really exciting, is that if you're, you know, creating a new category, because this is what we're talking about here, right, is the small iterative things are fine. But when you're kind of creating a new category, like an AirPod, you're moving things dramatically forward and redefining headphones. And in that moment, you're going to take up 80% of the market. And there's only 20% left for everybody else. And Apple have proved that time and time again with their ability to be able to kind of produce a real line in the sand product. And then, yeah, everybody then produces well, but nobody's got the lion's share. They've kind of, I guess, owned the market already. And classic example is the one you gave of the fact that you're now part of that ecosystem and you buy into it. And if they come out with the next new thing, whatever it might be, it will be good and it will solve a problem you didn't necessarily know you had, and you'll want it. And Apple will have 80% of that market, and Samsung, whoever's left, will have 20%. And I genuinely believe, and I've seen this in my own companies, that you apply this mentality and you end up in much the same place, is that it gives you that 1 or 2 year advantage over your competition, as long as you're going in the right direction, to be able to then come up with the next big leap. But you can't do the leap and then sit there and iterate. You have to keep leaping. You have to keep moving forward. You have to have the next one and the next one and the next one and be going there. And so in our small world of school websites and tech, I've seen lots of announcements in the last 6 months of data platforms and other things that we announced 2 years ago that we were working on. And, you know, some of those are bringing those products to market. And that's fine. You know, you've got mass adoption. We've got 80% of the DXP market. There's 20% left for everybody else. But we haven't been working on the DXP for the last 2 years. We've been working on the next thing, which will come out probably this year, that will have a similar profound impact. And so this is why I find it so fun. It's like, this is what a fun game. You're kind of, you know, getting out ahead, you're doing things that nobody kind of knows you're doing. You're part of this business where obviously my team and everybody within it, or most of the people within it, know our direction. And you're building all this really cool stuff ready to unleash on the world and, you know, choosing a date and saying, right, let's push it out there and see how it goes. So, but yeah, secrecy and big leaps and not doing the predictable and trying to figure out where you can take it and create a new category in the thing that you're doing, I think is really important.
And in exactly the same way that you talked about Henry Ford, and if he'd asked people what they wanted, they would have said faster horses. I think I remember Steve Jobs, when he was still with us, saying that he doesn't run focus groups, because if he did run focus groups, or if Apple ran focus groups, then if people had been asked if they wanted an iPad, they would have said no. But it wasn't until they invented, well, okay, people say that there was a tablet beforehand, but there wasn't really, let's face it. When Apple came out with it, people realized, actually, I really want this and I kind of need it. So it's interesting the way that it works.
But the point you made there is really relevant, is that the innovation wasn't the product, a tablet. The innovation was the user experience of said tablet, making it usable in a way that it actually had some value. Because, you know, yeah, you're right. There was probably some tablets before it that did some stuff, but in a way that wasn't very convenient, that felt a little bit clumsy, that, you know, was awkward. And so what Steve Jobs obviously did was say, well, hold on, you know, I've got a piece of hardware here, but my big leap is going to be in how I deliver a much better experience with this piece of hardware, and that's going to change the world. And that's what was done. But you're absolutely right. We do a lot of focus groups and things like that, so I've got to be careful what I say here. But I don't love focus groups, because I think they kind of draw a circle around everything and make it really small, because the conversation, the feedback loop, is within the realms of what everybody already knows and understands. And actually, to innovate, you've kind of got to draw a bigger loop around that loop and say, but what's the bit that we've not thought about yet? And focus groups are not very good at that. There's some kind of psychology around how you shouldn't get people in a room and do a focus group. You should get them all to go and write their ideas down in isolation, and then come to said focus group and have conversation, because by then being able to kind of really not have that influence of others and go back to almost first principle thinking, you get some actual originality into it. Whereas the majority of focus groups is this product, or even we're talking about, you know, the innovative things about this school or that school are very closed, and, you know, one person's afraid to speak out or come up with anything new or even try something a little bit different. So yeah, you know, you're back to that realm of, you know, asking people what they want, you'll get the predictable answers. How do you figure out what they need or what they don't even know they need yet and provide a solution to that? And I probably spend 70% of my thought process on that, which is where are we going next and what is the next thing? And it's not technology. The technology is the facilitator. It's problem solving. And as technology evolves, I can solve more problems. So technology is kind of hand in hand, but the technology doesn't lead. It's the solving of the problem. You know, marketing people in schools, because we, you know, that's our industry, producing lots of blog content and loads of content, but not knowing what works and what doesn't. Yet they're top poor. That doesn't make sense. Someone's got to come up with a solution that says, this is how you know which pieces of content or which things that you're doing are working and what and resonating, and with which audience as well. So I think you have to think a little bit differently to come up with a different idea and not do the predictable.
Okay, talk to me about this then, Dan. If we're looking at the subject of competition, then clearly to understand what our competition is, we need to look at our competitors. However, I find when I look back over 13 years of running my own business, the times where I've advanced it more than any other time are the times where I'm ignoring the competition and just kind of plowing on ahead with what I think is the right thing to do based on what my customers are asking. That's not a case of me looking at my competition and thinking, oh, they're doing that. Maybe I should be doing that. Or they're doing that. They're probably doing it better than me. And now I'm getting imposter syndrome. Actually, if I just put the blinkers on and just go full steam ahead, then that kind of, well, they are the moments where my business has advanced more than any other time.
I think on that we agree. And that one of my rules is to never look at what my competition are doing and to insulate myself from that. You can't always do that. And occasionally something comes up and, you know, you see it and, you know, you've got to kind of be very disciplined and to not react to it. But I think the most important thing is to not follow someone else's roadmap and to build your own and to not get caught up with a feature race, because that's the same stuff as we talked about before, which is just the small iterative change. You know, I've got this feature. No, I've got that feature. You need to be making those big steps. So I virtually don't exist on social media. I've got a LinkedIn account. That's it. I don't follow any of the people that you would call competitors in our market. I don't look at anybody's social profiles, and I don't look at what anybody else is doing. In fact, it's really important that I don't do that. Otherwise, I might influence my thinking about where we need to go next. And so actually, it's part of the process to ensure I don't, because even if it's inadvertent, I'm starting to be influenced by somebody else or something else up to where they're going and what they're doing. And we've got a mission. We've always had a mission. Every business should have its mission. It should just be full steam ahead trying to fulfill that, regardless of what everybody else is doing, in my opinion.
Do you think there's room for collaboration with our competition?
That's a good one. Yes, but it's got to be complementary, right? It's got to be a way in which I think benefits both sides. And that becomes problematic if you're kind of both going for the same customer in the same space. So, you know, you can be, and we have a number of partnerships where they have a website component to their business, or they have a area that we also cover, but it's not our core. And therefore, you know, we do work together and we do exchange opportunities and things like that. But
so again, going back to Apple, in a similar way to how Samsung will manufacture some of the displays that Apple uses in their products, whereas Samsung also makes their own phones.
Exactly right. So, you know, yeah, you've got to be open to obviously making your product the best it possibly can be, or your service, whatever it might be. And if that means collaboration with others, then that's what you should do in order to deliver the best customer service. I think to be stubborn and dig heels in and say, just because you're a competitor, we can't talk to you or can't have a relationship with you is really blinkered. But I think those that are, I don't want to say losing, but those that are in, let's say, second place and below, There's a lot of resentment, and there's a lot of, I guess, I don't know if it's the word's jealousy, it might not be, it might just be frustration that they're not in number one spot. And so, you know, the Apples of this world can call the shots, and the others kind of have to follow a little bit. And so, you know, you find from those others, they're often quite frustrated. They don't want to work with the bigger company in the space, and they're potentially very critical of that company as well. So we've got a ton of partnerships, and some of our partnerships are even website providers. But we have absolute confidence that there's nobody anywhere near us in terms of what we're doing. And if a school wants what we're doing and is a fit for us because it's a two-way fit, then there's no chance that any of those others would get selected. Now, that's not to say they're not any good. They're very good at what they do in a number of areas, but not specifically in ours. And we're trying to capture a specific type of customer that wants a specific type of outcome and has a specific fit for us as well. So, yeah, I'm all for collaboration, but yeah, on the right set of kind of mutual gain circumstances. What's your view on competition? Do you spend much time kind of looking at what others are doing, or where do you get your inspiration for where you're going next with your business?
It's a great question. And generally speaking, I find that because I'm operating in a niche market of private schools around the world, then generally the people who do what I do tend to provide this service to anybody in their local area, as opposed to looking at a niche market anywhere in the world. So I'm always prepared to travel or to provide a service online where I can service people, whether they're in North America, in Europe, or the Middle East, less so in Australia, a little bit in the Far East. The nature of my business is essentially podcasting, creation of video content and photography as well. And, you know, clearly the podcasting can be done online, just like we're doing right now. Yeah, I generally find that the people that do photography and video in particular just do it for people within a 30, 40 mile radius from where they live. And that's not really what I wanted to do. So yeah, whenever I come across somebody who does something similar to with one of my customers, then I usually find that they also do a number of other things and they're not really niching it down in a specialized market. So usually I can come across as the authority in that space. And usually that means, of course, that they're charging a lower amount of money, which isn't a problem for me. That's fine if they're happy to undercut, but to provide, frankly, a lower service. Then for some schools, for some of my clients, that may well be absolutely perfect. If they're facing the struggles of VAT like we are in the UK at the moment, then in the private schools market, then maybe that's the right route for them to take. So it is a little bit different, but I do kind of pride myself actually in just being in that niche market and being confident to turn down something that, you know, if somebody came to me saying, hey, can you come and video my wedding? I'd say, well, no, here are three people who I know who do it brilliantly. But, you know, I'm not tempted to try to change what I do in order to meet that customer need just so that I can get an extra few thousand pounds or dollars in this month. So that's the approach that I tend to take. So far, it seems to have worked for me.
Yeah, I had a funny situation actually a couple of weeks ago where we had a couple of inquiries in from schools that just weren't a fit. And I phoned up a competitor and said, do you want these opportunities? And they didn't quite know what to say or do. Just talking about collaboration, I said, look, there's no way that they're in our price bracket and they actually don't want what we do. It's not the right fit. They just want a real straightforward website, no bells and whistles. This is a kind of cost related exercise for them. And, you know, I'm not going to convince them that they need to do anything other than that. And so it makes sense that I give them to somebody that is going to service them properly. And they were like, well, what do you want in return? I said, I don't want anything. These are going to go nowhere, but I've got a customer that wants a website. They need some help. And I think you guys can, from what I can see, help them. And they said, yep, thanks. You know, but yeah, it definitely caused a little bit of kind of like, well, what are you really trying to do here?
Yeah.
Why are you really doing this? And there was no ulterior motive whatsoever. It was a couple of primary schools, a multi-academy trust and a secondary school that come in as inbound inquiries. Super ambitious schools for what they were, but just definitely not able to interact with our kind of price or even our approach. And so it was like, look, you know, there's a better fit over here. Have a look and see what you think. And the customer really appreciated that as well, that we would go and do that and kind of look out for them. Having put a bit of effort to contact us, we were prepared to say, no, not a fit, but here's someone that might be.
Nice. I like that. I really do. Dan, I'm keeping an eye on time, but for future episodes, what other things would you like to be talking about on this podcast?
We said fundraising, didn't we? That's an important one. I think, you know, the fuel is the fundraising behind the trajectory. We can grow organically, but if we can inject some cash into that situation, we can often, you know, move at 10x the speed we otherwise could do. So I think there's a real interesting topic around fundraising. And I've got, you know, a set of views. I've never gone down the VC route, but I've been a part of it. I've always gone for angel investors and things like that. So I think, you know, there's a minefield of topics that small businesses need to think about. And also that, I think we've talked about this on a more personal level, that kind of giving up equity and when you should and shouldn't, and whether it makes sense, and, you know, kind of 100% of nothing, still zero. And so sometimes giving away a little bit of something to make that into something more valuable makes a ton of sense. So, yeah, I think the fundraising, I think we've got one on scaling as well. How do you actually scale a business? What does that mean? And what are the kind of key components to being successful within that? Because, you know, we've gone from two people to, I think the last count was 68 as of last week. And we've got five new hires coming in next month. Things move fast. And scaling is not easy. It's arguably harder than proof of concept. And so that, I think there's a real topic there that we could delve into. Are there any that you have on your list in terms of key topics?
You know, I'm really glad that you mentioned about fundraising. I could almost see us sliding into that whole podcast recording right now. So we need to be slightly careful about that. Because, you know, I've often looked at whether I'm restricting the growth of my own business by bootstrapping it too much. And given the nature of this podcast being Scale Up Success, I think scaling and fundraising are two critical episodes that should absolutely come next. I'm completely with you on those two. So I think we should get a date in the diary, get those recorded and get them released as fast as possible.
Yeah, for sure. And there'll be others as well. Yeah, there's one thing I was going to mention just before we finish off, back onto the competition side, which I think is interesting, is what Elon Musk did at Tesla, where he effectively released all the plans for the electric cars, which is a new kind of thought process entirely about market adoption. So, you know, electric cars, great concept, but struggling really in terms of growth and sales. He needed not just Tesla to be offering electric cars, but he needed the rest of the world to be offering electric cars so that he could be the best one of the electric cars. And so it's a real fascinating process where they literally published online all of their research, all of their planning, all of the work that they'd done to develop the first versions of the Tesla, and said, there you go. Everybody, copy it, build out your cars, and then together we will effectively make a new industry, a new category. But I will be category king because I'm there first, and I'm giving you kind of the roadmap from 18 to 24 months ago, not today's roadmap, because we're already way, way ahead of that. And I just think that's an interesting concept altogether of like what you do and don't share with your competitors.
So do we expect to see you sharing your roadmap then with all of your competition?
We have been. We've been sharing our roadmap of what we did 2 years ago today and over the last 12 months. It's just not what we've been working on for the last 12 to 18 months, because we're happy to share that. It's the same with, you know, my marketing team. It drives them nuts because they're like, they'll know something's there, but they're not allowed to talk about it. And they'll say, well, you know, why not? And I was like, well, we want the most competitive advantage for that release that we can possibly get. And the longer it takes for people to figure out what we're doing, how we're doing it, and the value that it brings, the bigger the window we've got of benefit, and we stay category king as a result of that. And so it's quite tactical. This is why it's so much fun. You know, it's a bit of a kind of cat and mouse game in a way, of figuring out how you can kind of stay ahead and not get dragged in with the rest. Continue to try and do new things and innovate.
I can see that you treat it as something fun. I mean, I can see it in your face when you're talking, and it's refreshing. It really is, because you know, if we can run our own businesses and make them fun at the same time while scaling them up, then, you know, what's not to like about that?
I can't think of a better thing to do than create businesses and grow them and build communities. You know, there's nothing more exciting for me than it's the weird stuff, actually, but it's my teams all kind of meeting up for things and having friendships from previous companies and, you know, those connections that have been made for life as a result of you building this thing. And that's what I love the most is, you know, speaking to people that have worked with me 15 years ago that have then met other people through our business that they stayed in touch with, that they have personal connections with. It's so powerful what you can do as a business. Obviously, you make some money, great. But actually, you know, right now there's 68 people that we're employing. They've all got families. They're all making additional connections with our team, with their customers, with everybody else as well. And it's just, you're creating this whole kind of ecosystem. So yeah, I mean, it's super fun. I mean, there's bits that aren't, but yeah, you know, I can't think of what else I would rather do than build businesses.
I love that. Dan, I think it's a great place for us to stop this recording. We've got new episodes coming out soon, new episodes to be recorded soon. So I'm looking forward to all of those and looking forward to getting new content out. But in the meantime, thank you for being here.
Pleasure.
So there you go, an episode on competition in the workplace. I honestly can't wait for those upcoming episodes on raising finance and scaling. That's all in the very near future, so click the option to follow or subscribe, and it'll just make sure you don't miss those episodes when they come out. We'll see you next time. Bye for now.